Hi, listeners, and welcome to the True Crime Weekly podcast, a podcast that is based in San Diego and hosted by me, Alina Trujillo, and my producer, Jose Fernandez. This is a podcast where I will be bringing you stories of murders, infamous cases, and unsolved mysteries. In August of 1984, 14-year-old Claire Hoff and her best friend, Kim Jammer, went on a two-week vacation to San Diego, California. They stayed at Claire Hoff's grandparents' house, and the girls spent their days hanging out on Torrey Pines Beach, not far from where they were staying. And one of the nights, Kim and Claire snuck out of the house and headed down to the beach where groups of teenagers like to, you know, sit around bonfires, drinking beers, smoking cigarettes. And Kim got panicked all of a sudden that night. She felt very uneasy. She said, and I quote, "Somebody could just walk right up to you without you even knowing they were there," end quote. She got scared and had a really bad feeling and began to cry. Claire agreed to go home that night, and Kim had such a bad feeling that she even warned Claire not to go back out there at night anymore. Claire's friend Kim went back home to Rhode Island, and on August 23rd, a night after Kim returned, she went back to her bedroom, and her grandparents assumed she had gone to bed. But Claire snuck back out to the beach alone. This is the story of Claire Hoff. Unfortunately, Claire Hoff did not return to her grandparents' house that night. The next morning, 61-year-old Wallace Wheeler came across her body on the beach near Soledad Creek under the old Highway 101 bridge. She lay dead next to her boombox, covered in blood on a bloodstained bath towel. Her left breast had been cut off and her genitalia had been mutilated. Her killer had filled her mouth with sand.
That's awful. Just like a gruesome, gruesome murder.
The coroner reported he found no semen on one of the two vaginal swabs that were taken from Claire's body. But the other swab was transported to the San Diego Police Department's crime lab, and it was stored away.
Okay.
So the San Diego County coroner determined that Claire Hoff had been strangled to death. And the forensic pathologist reported that because he found no traces of semen on her body, she had probably not had been raped. So in the days after Claire's body was found, the man who found her, Wally Wheeler, presented himself as a suspect with his own odd behavior. Well, Claire's parents visited the crime scene, and Wally approached them on the beach and introduced himself, claiming to be a psychic. So he said he was an army veteran, having served in World War II, and once had a career as an insurance salesman. But by 1984, he was living with his sister, which happened to be very close to Claire's grandparents' house, where she was staying, So most say he was suffering from mental illness, and he spent most of his days collecting cans on the beach. So he spoke to the Hubs for half an hour, and he claimed to have been a night pilot. He even told them that he could see in the dark.
Oh, superpowers.
But at no time during, you know, the half an hour did he mention that he had found Claire's body. So Claire's parents told investigators they found him suspicious, and authorities, of course, agreed. Shortly after they met, Wally began corresponding with Claire's parents. His letters to them were kind of odd, rambling notes, okay?
He would send them letters?
So he talked of Claire coming to him in visions in these letters, okay? And he would say how she had a smiling face and radiant eyes. And that was the kind of thing that Claire's father, Sam, found disturbing, okay?
Well, yeah, how could you not? This is just really bizarre.
Right. Well, okay. Not only that, but Sam, Claire's father, said, "This is a guy who found a bloody, mutilated body, and he's talking about a smiling face and radiant eyes."
Yeah, that's just That seems weird.
And,
like, just the whole thing, he seems very suspicious. But then again, I guess the mental issue thing, I don't know.
That's true.
Kind of bizarre.
Right. So in one letter, Wally claimed to witness the murder in a psychic vision. He described the attacker as a long-haired man with a high forehead and a missing ear.
He's like Van Gogh?
Yes. So Wally said, and I quote, "I believe he immediately attacked and strangled her. He was crouched over her shoulders, and I just don't have a clear picture of what he was doing, but I would think it was when he mutilated her. End quote.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's just really bizarre. I mean, he could be making all this stuff up in his head, too.
Right. Well, yeah.
The whole Van Gogh portion is kind of weird.
So, without a question, Wally was investigators' prime suspect, and they tried everything to build a case against him, even going as far as to set up a microphone in a memorial that was set up for Claire. Okay.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So they thought there was a possibility that Wally might visit the memorial and say something incriminating.
Yeah, that's smart. That's, I mean, as much as this guy talks, you know, right. I'm sure he's not just talking to the parents, but anybody who wants to listen.
Mm-hmm. So Claire's dad kept corresponding with Wally and tried to trick him into also saying something that would show that he had killed Claire. Mm-hmm. But they spent years trying to build a case against Wally, and no matter what they tried, Wally didn't say or do anything that implicated him in Claire's death.
That's so weird. I mean, just think about that. Obviously, we're thinking about this or talking about this case many, many years later.
Right.
But at that point in time, this was the prime suspect for years, and they couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
To try to kind of like incriminate him in any way.
I know. That must have been very frustrating.
Yeah, I bet.
So several years after Claire's death, Wally reportedly tried to commit suicide by driving his car over a cliff.
Really?
Yes. So some actually went as far as saying that this was for sure a sign that he was guilty. But others actually thought that this was actually due to the scrutiny from law enforcement.
Like the pressure that law enforcement was putting on him?
Mm-hmm. Another point of view was that he simply was mentally ill and his condition was deteriorating.
It's a possibility, too.
Right, because remember, he did seem to have mental illness issues.
Right.
So in 1988, Wally made another attempt, but this time he was actually unfortunately successful.
Oh, no.
So he jumped from the 13th floor of a apartment building. And for anyone who still believed he had killed Claire Huff, the chance to bring him to justice was now lost with him having to commit suicide.
I imagine back then, everybody probably thought it was him.
Right.
Like it had to.
Mm-hmm. So Wally had been the San Diego Police Department's most promising suspect. But with his death, the quest to discover who killed Claire Huff hit a roadblock. And there were very few credible leads. Wally was later eliminated as the killer through DNA analysis, though. Okay. So it wasn't until 2008 that the San Diego police publicly admitted that another gruesome unsolved murder, that murder was of Barbara Nantes and Claire Huff, might have been murdered by the same person.
So, interesting.
Yeah, so these two cases were early similar, but happened 6 years apart. And I'll tell you all about Barbara's murder when we come back after this commercial break. That was fantastic, Jose. You want to know what I just did?
What'd you do?
I opened up the new wine that I received from Wine of the Month Club. So do you, Jose, want to treat yourself or someone special to great wines month after month?
I would love to.
Well, now you can with Wine of the Month Club. With Wine of the Month Club, you get 3 different bottles of rare international wine every month. You get to choose from all red, all white, or mixed. You can also choose to do a package every 2 months or 3 months if that's a better option for you. And every package ships with their monthly newsletter covering your selections and our listener favorites. Fun facts!
We are a proud affiliate, which means if you go to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com/support-the-show and click on the Wine of the Club Month link and sign up, we will earn a commission.
You can support the show and get wine delivered to your door by using promo code HOLIDAY15 to get $15 off any 4-month club, or you can use promo code HOLIDAY20 for $20 off any 6-month club, which sounds like a win-win to me. You get to stay home during this COVID-19 pandemic, quarantine by yourself, and your wines.
And they ship free.
What? Hey, Jose. So you know that during this pandemic, it could even be scary to go to the grocery store sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you can save yourself that trip using Instacart. Instacart delivers groceries in as fast as 1 hour. Instacart highlights deals to help you save money. They find everything you usually buy. You can get smart suggestions for new items. They even pick the freshest produce and they keep your eggs safe too.
We are a proud affiliate of Instacart. So head over to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com/support the show and click their link.
15-year-old Barbara Nantes and 17-year-old Jim Ault went to Torrey Pines State Beach with friends, which happened to be that same beach that Claire Huff was brutally murdered 6 years later. As the night progressed, Jim and Barbara left for some privacy on the beach, and it was a perfect night at the beach. The waves were crashing in the background, the light of the bonfires along the beach, and it was just a nice, warm summer night on the beach in San Diego. And they happened to sip two of their sleeping bags together and held each other as they looked up at the stars.
Sounds like a really nice night at the beach.
Until they were attacked while they slept under the stars. So Jim Ault regained consciousness just after sunrise, with waves crashing into him and the taste of metal in his mouth that came from all the blood.
Wow, that's terrible.
Yeah, so he could hardly see because of how much blood was on him. His long blonde hair was soaked in blood. He could barely stand, and he didn't know where Barbara was. He managed to crawl his way back to the parking lot where his friends were parked in their car and knocked on the window. And Jim's friends have said before in documentaries that he was almost unrecognizable, that the only way that they knew it was him was because of his blonde hair.
Wow. Yeah. That's terrible.
Mm-hmm. So all he could gasp to his friends was, "Find Barbara." His friends ran back to the beach to search for Barbara, and they found Barbara a short distance away, dead on the sand behind a lifeguard tower. She had been sexually assaulted, strangled. Her breast had been mutilated with a knife. Her body appeared to be dragged and left behind that lifeguard tower. So the killer also ended up packing handfuls of sand into her mouth, just like how they did with Claire.
Yeah, now I see what you're saying about eerily similar. I mean, are you kidding? That's so many different pieces. Same beach, sand in the mouth, the breast being, you know, cut. That's terrible.
Yeah. So Jim was so severely beaten that he could not be considered as a suspect in Barbara's murder, okay? There was just simply no possible way that he could have self-harmed himself to that degree. I mean,
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, he was in a coma for days and he barely even survived the incident. And a metal plate was implanted in his head to replace part of his shattered skull.
Oh,
yeah, so it was just, there was no way that he could have had any part in this.
Right. Makes sense. I mean,
yeah, but what's even more frustrating was that he had no memory of what happened.
Oh, no. He's probably the only possible witness out there.
Yes, and that memory was just wiped out. So Barbara's murder remained unidentified. And considering the similarity of the two crimes, it definitely appears like it could be the same killer, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But with both victims having their left breast cut off, they were both strangled to death and they both had sand stuffed into their mouths. So it doesn't seem like it could just be a coincidence, right?
Right. There's no way.
Yeah. And on top of that, on the same beach, practically almost that same location. But connecting the two crimes years later still went nowhere.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was a blood spot found on Claire Huff's jeans, but it wasn't until 2012 that it was tested for DNA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the test results came back to match the DNA of convicted rapist Ronald Clyde Tatro.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So in 1975, Ronald kidnapped a woman in Arkansas, threw her in the trunk of his car, drove her to a remote spot, and raped her at knife point. Prior to his trial, Ronald spoke with a psychiatrist and said he had no control of his violent urges towards women. And this was a problem that he said went all the way back to his childhood.
Wow, must be really bad. I mean, for him to admit it that way. And I guess it kind of lines up with how brutal these attacks were, right?
Right. So Ronald's ex-wife told investigators that Ronald was a violent man who used to regularly tie her up and rape her.
Really?
Yeah. And she even said that Ronald had confessed to her about murdering a woman on his way home from Fort Lewis, Washington. And she even said she didn't believe him at first, but later went to authorities with what he had said.
I mean, how crazy do you have to be to just pull that out of nowhere? Right. I mean, that's not a normal thing.
Yeah. So Ronald was paroled in 1982, and that's when he decided to move to San Diego. So just 6 months before Claire Huff was murdered, Ronald was a suspect in the murder of a sex worker, Carol DeFleece, in El Cajon Boulevard. So the year after Claire's murder in 1985, Ronald was convicted of attempted rape when he tried to lure a La Mesa teenager girl into his van and attacked her with a stun gun.
Wow, that's horrible.
Yeah. So obviously detectives were thinking that Ronald could have possibly been involved in Claire Huff's murder. So as they try to locate him, they find out that Ronald died the previous year in what was initially deemed a boat accident on the Holston River in Tennessee.
Really?
That's
really just before this?
Yeah. So two fishermen found his body floating face down in the water just 3 feet deep. His 12-foot boat was found 6 miles upstream, stuck in the brush along the riverbank. So it was thought that Ronald fell over and drowned in the river, and currents could have quickly separated him from his boat, leading him to drown.
Right, that makes sense.
However, there was something odd about the drowning. So Tennessee Wildlife and Resources Agency took photos of the boat when it was found, and it didn't look like Ronald had fallen overboard.
What do you mean?
Well, the seat on the fishing platform was found folded down over his wallet and driver's license, and his hat and glasses had been left on the floor as if he intended to go into the water.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Like a little swim or like a suicide?
I mean, I don't know. So his body was found on August 25th, 2011, but investigators believe he had been in the water for a day when he was found. And get this. Here's a little fun fact. Ready for this?
Ready.
The day that Ronald went into the water was the same day of Claire Huff's murder, only 27 years later.
Wow. So like the anniversary of her murder?
Mm-hmm. So, medical records indicate that Ronald has suffered from depression and had previously tried to kill himself by slitting his wrist as he awaited trial for his stun gun incident on the La Mesa teenager in 1985. Mm-hmm. So, toxicology reports from Ronald's autopsy revealed he had sleeping pills in his system on the day he died. Although the medical examiner ruled his death an accident, the report concluded Ronald's death may not have been an accident at all.
Wow. So I guess, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Like what you see on the boat doesn't really add up to an accident, I guess, but it's hard to say.
Yeah. So crime lab practices were also very different, okay? So it wasn't out of the norm for lab personnel to not use gloves and use the same tools for multiple cases without sterilizing them.
Oh, man. There's like a clear example of what's going to happen. Well, cross-contamination.
Right, but they didn't know about that back then. I mean, they didn't know much about DNA. They didn't know any of this.
Yeah,
so it seems true. Like it was just a lack of knowledge about trace and cross-contamination. And Detective Mike Lambert of the San Diego Police Department continued his investigation and tried to see if Kevin had any connections to Ronald. And the idea was that Kevin knew Ronald and that they had murdered Claire Huff together.
Really?
Yeah.
You just like trace, like a small amount of trace evidence of the semen?
Right. But I guess that's not how they're seeing it. They're still trying to connect the two. So
yeah.
Mike claimed that the lab manager told him that cross-contamination was not possible and that helped him obtain a search warrant.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So with the warrant in hand, the San Diego Police Department went to Kevin Brown's house along with his wife, Rebecca. They ended up taking 14 boxes of evidence, including over 20,000 photographs, including family photo albums, cameras, laptops, and videotapes.
Okay.
So Kevin has now turned into the key suspect in the murder investigation.
That's just crazy to me. I mean, it sounds like either this guy is like potentially some sort of serial killer or something too, or it's just like an example of cross-contamination.
Right. Well, according to Kevin Brown's wife, Rebecca, Kevin's anxiety and depression grew as she claimed that the police preyed on him. So Kevin became fixated on the return of the family's possessions. So he started keeping a calendar in his closet, and he would mark off each day with a bold black X for every day that became closer to him getting his 14 boxes that had been seized. So according to Rebecca, once they got the items back, they planned to rejoice in the end of this nightmare, quote unquote, by spending the night at a hotel. And in his mind, she said, he believed that the return of the belongings signaled the end of the investigation. So he was just looking forward to getting his stuff back because that would mean he was in the clear.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely terrible. I can't imagine how stressful that would be.
Well, yeah, you know, you're just counting down the days. So unfortunately, though, that day never came. In September, Rebecca had come home on a Friday evening to find that her husband had attempted to commit suicide. Her husband was in bed and a letter on the floor next to a bullet. And the letter began with, "Dear Becky, thank you for the last 20 years. So obviously, she confronted her husband about this letter and the bullet that was on the floor, and Kevin denied that it was a suicide note or that he was even attempting to commit suicide. But Rebecca didn't believe him, and she said she warned Michael that the investigation was causing her husband to have suicidal thoughts and that they needed to return the family's seized belongings immediately.
Yeah, because it seemed like that's what was he was so fixated on, right? So since that wasn't happening, now he's like just mentally not doing good.
Mm-hmm. So then on October 20th, 2014, Kevin bought a rope at a hardware store, drove to the couple's cabin in Cuyamaca Rancho State Park, and hanged himself from a tree.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. So at this point, police still suspect that Kevin was the murderer, and they got another search warrant. But this time it was for the couple's cabin, hoping to find evidence. But this time, Kevin didn't leave a note.
I mean, I guess they were trying to find to see if there was a note admitting to what he did.
Right. So 4 days after his death, police publicly identified him as a suspect in the cold case murder of Claire Huff. 4 days after his death, police publicly identified him as a suspect in the cold case murder of Claire Huff, along with Ronald. And in a news release, police said that he committed suicide just as, and I quote, "preparations were being made for Kevin Brown's arrest," unquote. So this created headlines across the country. The statement was very clear that the police suggested that he was guilty.
That's crazy to me because, I mean, I don't know. From what we're seeing here, there isn't probably enough evidence to say that he did it.
Right.
Unless they found more, I don't know. But
his DNA was on there. But again, the way that crime labs were ran back in the day, you know, was it that it was really there or was it that it was used as a sample to test?
Yeah, I mean, that's really scary. If it was truly just cross-contamination.
Right.
Because of how things work. Because you think about it, there's obviously we see cases all the time of DNA being tested because there's new ways and stuff, and they're still using the same evidence that was collected years and years ago.
Right.
So what's to say that this couldn't possibly happen again if that is what happened?
Right. And that's what I find so interesting about this case, because, you know, that's exactly what I was thinking too. You know, what is there, are we going to hear more cases like these?
Yeah,
you know?
Being thrown out possibly. Right. It's true. I mean, this could be an example. I don't know.
Yeah. So Rebecca Brown filed a lawsuit against the San Diego Police Department and Michael Lambert, claiming that Kevin committed suicide as a result of an abusive police investigation. So after one day of deliberation, the jury awarded Rebecca Brown with $6 million in damages, agreeing that SCPD detectives violated Kevin Brown's constitutional rights, leading to his suicide.
Wow.
Yeah. So the jury verdict targeted now retired SCPD homicide detective Michael Lambert. Plaintiffs alleged Michael abused his authority when he lied in a search warrant affidavit and seized property outside the scope of the warrant. So the jury...
Just 20,000 pictures?
Yeah. So the jury awarded $3 million in damages related to illegal search and seizure of property. And another $3 million in damages was related to the widow's loss of her husband due to abuse of power during the police investigation.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So Kevin Brown committed suicide in October 2014, 10 months after officers served the search warrant in his home in Chula Vista.
So, I mean, this really means that if Rebecca was awarded this, it kind of seems like, no, he isn't a suspect then. That's the way I'm seeing it, obviously.
Yes and no, because I feel like this is just the court's way of saying we acknowledge that the investigation was not treated properly. I don't know that they actually are saying, no, he was not guilty. I think they're just saying, okay, yeah, we acknowledge that the investigation was not properly conducted.
Yeah. Well, just, I mean, it's terrible, because then at some point, he's still kind of tied to this case, and we have no idea whether or not, you know, if that's valid. I mean, again, it could be cross-contamination.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, and then that's just this poor innocent guy that ended up getting so much pressure from the police, one of their own, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that might be the reason why they were going so hard on him. It could be because they were trying to show that there isn't favoritism to, you know, just because you're a police officer or part of the forensics team that, you know, you can get away with this type of stuff.
Right. Yeah, and unfortunately, it just seems like these are three tragic stories that left
a lot of pain for the families. Everybody that's kind of fell behind.
Yep.
Just tragic.
If you want to look at pictures and want more information on the cases we cover, you can head over to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at Podcast True Crime Weekly. And please don't forget to support the show by going to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com/support the show. And I would truly love it and appreciate it if you leave a 5-star review and subscribe onto Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The only way that people find out about us is through subscribers and reviews. Thanks for listening.